Epimenides, Part 2. The Corps of Discovery wintered for 5 months. The fiddler played long lamentations at night, and the men talked of home. Even after the weather was not inclement, the rumor of the river was adverse. Travel may be unnecessarily imperiled, and so they abided, and put themselves to the task of building canoes as the Mandan taught them to do, and to making leather clothing, which they found more serviceable than the broadcloth that they wore, and making moccasins of parflesh, or cured buffalo hide, just as they were taught by the French and Indian alike to fabricate for good use. In early April, the wind still continued from the northwest, and the days were still very cold. Shahaka, the chief of the lower village, came to apprise them that the buffalo were near, and that his people were waiting for them to join in a chase. The captain set his hunter with his dog and some others out, and they found the Indians already engaged in killing the buffalo, on horseback, armed with bows and arrows, circling the herd. The hunter on his horse, his dog racing ahead of him to nip the heels of the bison, joined up, and gradually they drove them into an open place fit for the movement of horse. They rode among them, singling out a buffalo, a female being preferred, and got as close as possible and wounded her with arrows, with spear, until they could give a mortal stroke. They did not use their rifles, but assisted the Indian in the manner that they hunted, and themselves tried the bow and arrow and the spear. They exhausted their quivers, and only then did the white men shoot with rifle. They killed large numbers, for this was the great harvest for the year. Not for their meat so much as for their skins, for the buffalo, after so long and harsh a winter, shall be tough and lean in meat, but shall have a thick and shaggy hide that is most excellent for the clothing and the blankets. So far as the eating is concerned, the best eating is late in the summer when the hump is fatty and rich. However, nothing was to be wasted, and what meat could not be immediately consumed was dried, and much of this pounded for pemmican. A hunter for the captain himself killed 10 buffalo, of which 5 only were brought to the fort. The rest, which could not be conveyed home, were seized by the Indians, among whom the custom is that whenever a buffalo is found dead, without an arrow or any particular mark, he is the property of the finder. I obtained traps from the French, and tried my hand at beaver while the corps was occupied in the early spring at the task of building canoe. One trapper showed me generously where I might try. The land so bountiful, the beaver so numerous, he did not prejudice that I should take his stock. Or perhaps he did not care for reasons more kindly than that. I found the beavers fat and their fur rich for the harsh winter. My fellow showed me how I should skin him and how take the preputial glands for baiting traps and what parts of him to eat. His tail was especially delicious. When boiled, it resembles in flavor the flesh of tongues and has a smell of codfish. It is usually sufficiently large to afford a plentiful meal for 2 men. My dog lost all her respectable manners over its meat, and would steal from my plate. She loved it so much. Embarked at last in early May, the river, having risen with spring melt, was high and swift, but now easily navigable. The canoes, though very good effort was required to strike against that current, made quick passage up it with many men at paddles, and soon they witnessed for the first time in the distance the mountain range that they sought. The hunter, moving ahead of them, found no Indians as he approached them, and found that the elk and antelope seemed so unfamiliar with man that they were gentle and could be passed without distraction while they fed. No proximity excited any alarm among them, and some even approached him in curiosity. It made him hesitate to kill them, and he chose to kill only those who straggled from the others of their kind, as though having been cast out from them for old age or infirmity or for a crime, if crime should exist among so gentle a creature as these. A word upon these mountains that they saw. The hunter had been a happy wanderer in his youth, and he knew the wilds of the Appalachia. He had hiked its shady peaks often, but those were hills compared to these. These were rocky, lofty, barren, shrouded in snow and cloud-bound often, when clouds were scattered from them by shrill, wild winds and their sharp peaks and craggy spines revealed against the deathless sky, streaking frost into the air. He saw them so starkly stony, so keenly edged and scintillating in the sun, that he felt them frightening, though he could not say why. He understood why the ancients said that the gods dwelt in such mountains. These were places that man could not, dared not go, and yet he felt drawn to them, and wanted to desert the obligations he had to take himself to them. They taunted him, as they were always present. They had the allure of mystery, and though the very opposite, they fascinated him to look upon like an abyss. The great height, the great depth seemed the same. How birth and death are the same. It is perhaps the essence each contains. It is not anything I can explain. I feel that I will never know myself until I've reached these mountains. He circled back to regain the core, bearing meat as he always did, now taking a canoe that had been left for him at the river, and following the bank where the current was less extreme, his dog sitting in the bow, looking alertly forward. He came up soundlessly upon the other canoes as they were traveling slowly ahead, seeking to make camp. There he saw that two canoes in the rear had broken off behind the main body and had gone ashore for some practical purpose. There the men had discovered a large brown bear lying in the open grounds, about 300 paces from the river. He watched as these six men immediately went to attack it, concealing themselves by a small eminence, creeping unperceived to within 40 paces of it. Four stood upright in the brush and fired upon it, and presumably each hit it, each lodging a ball in his body, perhaps directly in its lung. But the animal sprang up furiously, enraged, and ran open-mouthed upon them. And as he came near, the remaining two had reserved their fire, gave him two more wounds, one of which broke his shoulder and retarded his motion for a little. But before any could reload, the bear was so near that they were obliged to run toward the river. Before they reached it, the bear had almost overtaken them. The hunter's dog jumped from the bow of the hunter's canoe while he steered toward the fracas. The dog swam toward the bear as the two men jumped into their canoe and parted the shore swiftly. The other four had separated on the bank above the river, concealing themselves in the willow, then fired as fast as they could reload. They struck him several times, but instead of weakening the monster, each shot seemed only to direct it towards them until at last it pursued the two of them so closely that they threw aside their guns and pouches and jumped down a perpendicular bank of 20 feet into the river. The bear sprang after them into the river and was within a few feet of them when the dog lunged upon its back and distracted it. The bear scrambled back to the shore with the dog seized upon his back and wheeled violently about until he hurled the dog into the bank and reared and walked two-legged and was prepared to drop and charge upon the dog and kill it, when the hunter, kneeling in his canoe, shot the bear in the head, and it dropped dead at the water's edge. It took all seven of them to drag his body to where they might butcher it. It was so enormous. And they found that 8 balls had passed through him in different directions. The bear was old and the meat was tough, so that they only took the skin and gave up their supper and rejoined the camp. This was the first time that they had seen a grizzly bear. The water standing in the vessels froze during the night, 1/8 of an inch thick. The air was so pure in this open country that mountains and other elevated objects appeared much nearer than they really were. These mountains did not appear to be further than 15 miles. The captain sent the hunter and his dog up a creek to reconnoiter them. He returned after nightfall and informed him that he had proceeded 10 miles directly toward these mountains, and that he did not think himself by any means halfway closer. They seemed to recede even as they grew larger. Mountains rose as he approached, seeming more forbidden, barren, steep, higher, and rocky, even as he encountered dense and fragrant pine woods skirting them. While I stood in the Kansas prairie and was alone and looked out upon its empty vastness there, I felt myself to be an insignificant speck, the smallest thing in all I viewed. Yet, here I stand before a majesty so huge and so magnificent I cannot describe it, and I feel myself exalted and enlarged by it. How much the world affects me! How much I am what it reveals to me! God, I want to stay here and never leave. The captain, receiving his report, made muttering reflections in the firelight on the difficulties which this snowy barrier would most probably throw in his way to the Pacific, and the sufferings and the hardships of himself and his party. It was a just counterbalance to the joy of beauty. He anticipated the worst. He complained obsessively and assumed a sullen melancholy. The hunter, for his part, turned away with this unspoken response. What is the profit of counting a loss before money is spent? If fish might swim in air, I would want to live to be 100. But I do not want to live again. Live once well, and die once well, I say. That very night, a mad rogue buffalo bull rampaged through the camp. Wherefore or from whence it was never known. It came alone, unexpected, like a cosmic thing. The anger of the jealous gods which enraged it put him there to wreak violence or punishment, or simply act out some insane delight for willful malice and mayhem. But for the hunter's dog, it might have killed many of them. Once again, the dog was the hero among them, racing rapidly around it, distracting and annoying it, and causing it to lunge in its direction rather than gore a fallen man. The hunter, along with the shot of several others, finally slew it in the midst where it collapsed and bled, a froth of blood upon his nostrils, still looking wildly at them as it died. It was after midnight before they finished butchering it. The next morning they found that the buffalo, in crashing through the camp, had trodden on a rifle which belonged to the captain's black man, and he was upbraided and struck because it was deemed a negligence to let it lie in the path of that misfortune. The rifle was much bent, and the bull had also broken the lock and shattered the stock of one of the blunderbuss in the negro's care. Struck a second and a third time, it was more truly the frustration of loss, more than the crime of the slave, which was the cause of the dismay. for they were finding and fearing that gradually losing the store and equipment that they had, as these occasionally disappeared in capsize, or inexplicable pilferage, or were inevitably worn or accidentally ruined, they might never achieve the objective that the president set for them. The captain remained morose and sour for weeks thereafter, though now the mountains and triumph loomed ever more close. Saw a beaver in a pond catchment made by their damming up of one of the creeks ahead of the corps, and my dog, per usual, swam in to catch it. As I took a shot at it, but I had missed, the beaver turned on her and chased and bit her through the hind leg and cut the artery. It was with great difficulty that I could stop the blood. I fear it will yet prove fatal. Carried her back to the encampment and turned her over to the captain to care for and returned to my hunt. Regret I wasted my shot on the beaver, but the wild is so abundant hereabouts, the hunt is very profitable. This was the most abundant period in the expedition for hunting and foraging, and the easiest hunting and foraging that they would ever find. It was like food dangled on bushes. The fabled land of Cockaigne, wherein sausages grow on trees and cooked fowl fly right into the open mouth, and beer runs in the streams. Shot more than they could eat, shot at will. The hunter idled most of his days and could explore the heights alone and wander ahead and look here and there for his own imagination's sake. The men were ravenous, even more than usual, for the portages were strenuous and canoeing hard against white water and knocking rocks. Even when on the plains, the men ate 9 pounds of meat a day, and whatever raspberries, currants, grapes, wild onions, etc. that they could find, and still were hungry. Now they seemed to eat 5 times a day. The captain complained, but like the bear, that they had to take their fill, and perhaps like the bear, it was a good thing they fattened now. Trout abounded. A sweet pan fry fairly leapt into the canoe. The diet was truly sumptuous. Buffalo humps as delicious as the sirloin of beef and as often as wanted. And buffalo tongues and succulent marrow bones, fine trout fried with parched cornmeal with pepper and salt, add to these tasty foods a good appetite. The last is not the least of the luxuries they enjoyed, and this time proved to be the best memory that most of these men had for all their life. Every night the fiddler had his happiest tune, and everything went well. One day, the corps met with 2 large bear on the shore of the raging river while portaging, and killed them both at the first fire, a circumstance which had never happened with the party in killing the brown bear before. They came upon turn after turn on the river as it climbed and drove through eminence and gorge, and had the most repeatedly beautiful and picturesque views of the Rocky Mountains, which were gorgeously covered with snow. Each succeeding range rising higher than the preceding one, until the most distant appeared to lose its snowy tops in the clouds. It was an august spectacle, rendered more awesome by the anticipation of their passage. At last they came to the Great Falls of Missouri, 2 milky, fuming cataracts, one above the other, which were the insurmountable obstacle and cascading gateway thence to the mountain territories and the long hike they must take. Here they must leave their canoes, store them up for their hopeful return, and find an unknown way to pass along breathless cliffs, beside deathly crevices and crumbling scree, and climb unexplored peaks. They break on through to the other side, to the Pacific Ocean that spreads and waits for them. It is June, and they had the better part of the summer for this adventure. I selected a fat buffalo cow and shot her through the lungs, but while I was gazing on the poor animal, blood in streams from her mouth and nostrils, expecting her to fall, I entirely forgot to reload my rifle. When a large albino bear perceived me and had crept up on me and was 20 steps away before I discovered him. In the moment that I drew up my rifle to shoot, I recollected that it was not loaded and that he was too near for me to load and prime before he reached me on his attack, for he was briskly advancing, mouth open and growling as he came. It was an open, level place, not a bush within or a tree within 100 yards of me. The river bank sloped at my left, and I was lucky to be near the level of the water. I threw down my gun for a better day, but I kept the espontoon the captain had lent me, which I had not thought much use as a weapon, but was a good tool to help a hike on a steep slope and the ledges that I had to traverse. I ran like hell, holding this instrument, and thinking I might present it to his face if he challenged me, and he gained on me fast. I ran into the water, and hoped to get into such a depth that I might swim, and hoped I might swim the better between the two of us. But in mid-river I still stood about waist deep, and so I looked back and turned about and presented the point of the espontoon to him. He got 10 feet from me. I could smell him. He looked at me, and I suppose he thought I looked ridiculous, or I don't know why, or what was happening. But he just as suddenly and ludicrously wheeled about and lumbered back off, back into the woods, without a pause or a farewell. Why I am still alive, I do not know. I got back out, picked up my gun, and was going to get my buffalo and butcher its meat, but found there was a general conspiracy against me that day. 3 mountain lion had come out and had got my prey while I was chased off by that bear, and they looked to destroy me, too, if I'd stayed. I might have thought the whole matter some dream or nightmare, except that I realized the prickly pears had pierced my feet severely when I'd run across them into the river, and I was almost lame to make my way to the camp, looking back warily for those cats that I was certain had my scent and were tracking my blood. In the high plains above the Great Falls, the ground was verily carpeted with these prickly cactus. They easily penetrated even double-soled moccasins and ruined most everyone's footgear, which had to be replaced until they got above this high plains. The hunter had difficulty walking for some days as they prepared to mount the falls. While he mended, he was gladdened to find that the dog had recovered, though she did chronically limp. She now was most genuinely his own dog, and fawned on him and greeted him first among all other men, and slept with him, preferring him now even to the captain as a kindred soul. It was not just the morsels of his food that he shared with her, for the captain tried to tempt her and spoil her with his own. But she always returned to the hunter after she was fed, and licked his face and nuzzled him. It rained for several days as they prepared to leave their canoes, which they had stowed and disguised with cover of broken limbs and brush. It rained almost without intermission for almost a week of days and nights, and made them all disagreeable and restless. The camp possessed no pleasures, and the rain so unremitting, the sky so intemperate, fate so obdurate, they tired of outwaiting it, and determined to depart half-heartedly and reluctantly. The rain was very cold, and the rain and wind continued to drive hard against them from the northeast. The ground was remarkably slippery, and they were almost unable to walk on the sides of the bluffs, which they had to pass to ascend the falls and the river above them. It was like walking over ice, which is thawing, this clay shedding water and adding slime to the slickness. They should have delayed, but they had gotten the unspoken belief that this rain, these cliffs, this place, was set before them permanently, and that if they didn't try, they would never escape, but would have to give up and go back. The hunter and the captain went out ahead of them alone along the face of the bluff above the falls, taking a ledge which was against the face of it, above the gorge of the river which was raging white and roaring below. The hunter had the captain's espontoon and kept it stabbed in front of him into the clay to help him keep his footing on the narrow way. But when the rain suddenly switched and whirled in a fit and smarted him like stings, he slipped at a narrows, and but for a quick recovery by stabbing the espontoon, he should have been fallen into the sucking river down the craggy precipice nearly 90 feet below, oblivion beckoning. He had scarcely felt his way to a place in which he could stand safely, even with the assistance of the espontoon pressed against the face of the bluff, and hardly able to turn or move, when he heard the voice of the captain behind him cry out, "Oh my God! Oh my God! What shall I do?" Turning about, he found the captain had slipped and fallen about the center of this narrow pass and was lying prostrate on his belly, his left hand and arm and leg slipping over the precipice while he held precariously on to the slippery ledge with his right arm and foot as well as he could. He expected every instant to see him lose his strength and slip off into the abyss. The hunter held his trepidations unexpressed and spoke calmly to assure him and said what he should do. He edged toward him, embracing the wall of the bluff, and told him, leaning toward him, to take the knife out of his belt behind him with his left hand and dig a hole with it in the face of the bluff to receive his left foot. The act of it so awkward, the captain nearly fell by the imbalance, and he lost his knife in the raging water, which seemed to be eager to consume him. He told him then to push his moccasins off his feet, to give himself the grip of his bare toes, and to try to get both knees upon the ledge. And this he succeeded to do, though his grip on the clay was lost suddenly, and he would have fallen except that the hunter threw his knife at him, to plunge it to the hilt of its blade into the streaming clay before the very face of the captain, who had almost believed he had intended to kill him. And the hunter shouted for him to use the knife to draw himself forward. So, in this manner, the captain came forward on his hands and knees, drawing himself forward with the knife, stabbing it ahead of himself, and drawing himself forward. And so the captain escaped his death. Those who were behind had not seen, but the hunter called for them to try another way to go around. In a little distance they climbed above the bluff, and as they lay upon their backs, grateful to be alive, rain upon their upturned faces, the captain said, "Do not tell the men what happened." In an hour the others joined them from a different, safer route. Suddenly the rain had ended, though it was cold and still misty as a fog about them. In those rising mists and the setting sun they made a fire and a close encampment of tents, and were glad for the flames and warmth and the hot food they cooked. Around their fire, sitting as the mists dispersed and were replaced by plumes of frosty breath as they spoke, the captain told the harrowing tale of how he had saved the life of the hunter, who had nearly fallen into the abyss. The dog leaned against the hunter as the tale was told. His head laid atop his knee.